You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix on this Wednesday, November the 26th, the day before Thanksgiving and less than a month to Christmas. Believe it or not, time is just flying. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay is a strategic planner that helps clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. He also serves as the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their business in the U.S., and his development labs create smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and internet marketer with a degree in philosophy. His political development is called The Solution, which is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper, a freelance interviewer and journalist in all media. Hey guys, welcome to the show today.
Hello.
Good morning.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. So Rick has gone somewhere for Thanksgiving. Where are you, Rick?
I am in South Dakota, my wife's family's house.
Oh, that's cool. Lovely.
Yeah.
I've never been.
I have been to South Dakota. From Canada, it's an easy drive through North Dakota, South Dakota, down through that way. So, Montana. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they have, is that the one, is it South Dakota that has the jackalopes all over the place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm looking at them right now.
You're looking at a jackalope?
I've heard of them.
Hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Jay, what's going on with you?
Nothing, just, getting ready for the holiday season, which seems to have started early. There used to be kind of a lull between Halloween and Thanksgiving, where you could kind of sort of get your head together, and that really didn't happen. It literally started the day after Halloween, but we're gearing up for Toys for Tots benefit on December 13th. That'll be down at the Westgate. And it's going to be a great show. I recommend everybody get tickets, come down. It's a great cause. The great thing about it is it's in the showroom. That's Elvis's stage. So it was literally built for him.
Which casino?
So Westgate, which used to be the LVH, which used to be the Las Vegas Hilton, which used to be the International when it was the International.
Is it not still the LVH?
No, it's now the Westgate.
Since when?
Since about two months ago.
2 months ago. Okay, I totally missed this. I did not know this.
Well, you take a nap here in Vegas, look what happens.
Yeah,
things
exactly.
Change. Tectonic plates are moving.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's cool. It's an historic showroom. It's actually probably one of the last historic showrooms in Las Vegas. I mean, it's literally Elvis's stage. So.
Nice. Okay. Good.
And Toys for Tots.
It's on 12, 13, 14. Toys for Tots. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. So, Rick, let's let everybody know who's listening, watching today. What exactly is this thing called The Solution?
The Solution. The Solution is a way to fix government spending, a way to possibly heal our political divide, at least the current political divide that we have right now. We'll always argue about something. Maybe we can get past this left-right divide and argue about something else. The idea is to cap government spending nice and tight so the political right is happy, and then take the money that's left and prioritize it. Now, we already prioritize our defense spending. We already prioritize all the little budgets we have in Congress, but we don't prioritize the social spending. So let's take that social spending and prioritize it, rake it from top to bottom so the most important stuff is on top and the waste, fraud, and abuse is exposed on the bottom. And as we prioritize over the years, we'll find better and better ways to use that purchasing power, and we'll actually improve the government's ability to help people and help the people who need help most while we maintain a sustainable budget, at least. In fact, there's an ideal balance point we have discovered where we can keep purchasing power the same and thus guarantee the same level of service as a baseline and to constantly improve on top of that, while still lowering taxes over time because the economy grows a little faster than that on average. So we can truly, pursue freedom and fairness at the same time. There's no compromise. It's just called cap and prioritize. It really is that simple.
Okay. So when you talk about possibly getting rid of the right-left divide, that's kind of an interesting concept, because it seems like human nature is to polarize, and people like to take a stand for something. They like to take sides. They like to segregate themselves into groups. So do you think we're ever going to truly get rid of that left-right divide?
Well, if you look at history over a long enough timeline, we are always dividing ourselves and getting angry and fighting, and then resolving that fight and moving on. There are some exceptions. You know, what's happening in the Middle East has been going on for quite a while, and that hasn't changed much over time. But if you look at, especially in the West, especially here in America, you know, we were founded just three lifetimes ago, 3 times 80. We fought for our independence, and then 2 lifetimes ago, we fought the Civil War to end slavery, and just over 1 lifetime ago, women won the right to vote. And now we're fighting about budgets and how to best use our budget. I mean, there's other arguments too, but that's the big one that really divides us as a nation. So will we solve our budget problem? Yeah, we will sometime. And that's what cap and prioritize is all about. Once we solve it, we will still argue about something, like I said. And so we will still be divided on some new topic. It just won't be this topic anymore. So I want you to imagine 20 years from now or so, a government that understands how to live within fiscal limits and use that money wisely and through competition find better ways to use that money. And then we're arguing about, in a sense, whatever the next issue is. And typically it's a smaller issue. Like we'll argue about foreign policy or whatever else, but we as a nation will be more healed than ever before. And so as that model spreads around the world, even the world will get less dangerous and more compatible. And so even those international problems might, temper down a little bit as well. So, I'm optimistic.
Okay, cool. Jay, what are your thoughts on that?
I hope we never stop arguing, actually, because it means that we stop. Well, let me clarify. It means we stopped asking questions, and that's not a good thing. I think what I think Rick's getting at is that the argument will become more civilized, less demonizing the other person. Right now it's, again, I've talked about this for the past couple of weeks, actually, during my segment, but it's someone will take a quote, take it out of context, or take the most lunatic statement of someone from the right or someone from the left and say, this is what the Democratic Party is. This is what the Republican Party is. And it's like, no, you got one guy who said something really stupid about women's rights and abortion. And he looked like a complete lunatic saying it, but you're putting it out there like it's that doesn't characterize one political ideology over another. And I think, we will get smarter, because last week I used the term less stupid, and Heather chastised me for that. I was trying to be a little poetic. But again, the arguments will become smarter and much more civilized over time because of that. It will ultimately make us smarter and more thoughtful.
Okay. So speaking of less civilized, let's go on to the top story. Out of Ferguson, National Guard reinforcements helped contain the latest protests in Ferguson, preventing a second night of the chaos that led to arson and looting after a grand jury decided not to indict the white police officer who killed Michael Brown. Demonstrators returned yesterday to the riot-scarred streets, but with hundreds of additional troops standing watch over neighborhoods and businesses, the protests had far less destructive power than the previous night. However, officers still used some tear gas and pepper spray, and demonstrators set a squad car on fire and broke windows at City Hall. Since the grand jury's decision, protesters in cities throughout the country have rallied behind the refrain, "Hands up, don't shoot," and drawing attention to other police killings. As the tension in Ferguson eased a bit, 28-year-old officer Darren Wilson broke his long public silence, insisting on national television that he couldn't have done anything differently in that confrontation. The toll from Monday's protests, 12 commercial buildings burned to the ground, plus 8 other blazes and a dozen vehicles torched, prompted Missouri government prompted Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to send a large contingent of extra National Guard troops. So he ordered the initial force of 700 troops to be increased to 2,200 in the hopes that their presence would help local law enforcement keep order in the St. Louis suburb. Guard units protected the Ferguson Police Department and left crowd control, arrests, and use of tear gas to local officers. 45 people were arrested, most of them for failure to disperse. Protesters threw rocks, tent poles, and bottles, some of them containing urine, at officers. As the crowd dispersed early this morning, some threw rocks through the windows of a muffler shop and a used car dealership near a painted mural that read, "Peace for Ferguson." How ironic is that? Large demonstrations were also held throughout the country for a second day yesterday. Some were peaceful, such as in New York, where a large Union Square protest broke into smaller groups that walked to places like Times Square and several bridges. And hundreds of Seattle high school students walked out of classes, while several hundred people marched down a Cleveland freeway ramp to block rush hour traffic. But other events weren't so calm. In Oakland, California, a crowd of protesters smashed windows at car dealerships, restaurants, and convenience stores. A rally that drew thousands in Minneapolis took a turn when a car struck a protester and drove through a pack of others. And in Portland, Oregon, police used pepper spray and made arrests after about 300 people disrupted bus and light rail traffic by walking across a bridge. The Brown family attorneys said that they hope an ongoing federal civil rights investigation leads to charges, but federal investigations of police misconduct have a steep legal standard. It requires proof that an officer willfully violated a victim's civil rights. Now, Brown's family could also file a wrongful death lawsuit against Wilson, regardless of any of the other outcomes. So, that's the top story, chaos around the country because of a decision in a courtroom. Jay, what do you think?
Yeah.
No.
Well, not in a courtroom, in a grand jury.
Yeah, okay, grand jury.
Not even that.
We can barely hear you, Rick.
Chaos is not
Go ahead, Rick.
Wait, can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're just
the
not very loud.
The chaos is not because of some decision. The chaos is because of the different world views that we have, the way that humans process information, the way that crowds work, the incentives that some people have to use any excuse they can to destroy things.
And isn't this just what we were talking about a few minutes ago? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But again, it's not because I agree with the whole report, except the last line, it's not because of the decision. It's because of the way people think and act and work.
So you think people are just waiting for some excuse to have riots and destroy property?
That's
part of it.
Yes, part of it. Yeah, I think there is a certain anger and a certain feeling of disenfranchisement and hopelessness. And sometimes this is the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. It's the one thing. It's the spark that ignites the inferno.
It would have been something else.
Ultimately, yeah. It's the whole thing is said. There are no winners. There are no losers. They're all losers. It's a tragic thing all around. None of us know what really happened between the officer and Mr. Brown, and so it's almost impossible to know what really happened, you would think we would learn that I've said before, protesting is the worst. If you really want to solve the problem, is not the way to do it. The way to do it is through legislation and through some kind of awareness and community action. But obviously, even a peaceful march to me doesn't do anything.
A peaceful march is better than destruction, which is just like why? How do you solve the destruction of one life by destroying multiple things? Like, it doesn't even make sense. There's no logic. There's no rationale.
It's okay. This actually isn't about Mingus. Actually,
and what they're destroying has nothing to do with the police officer. What they're destroying is car dealerships and businesses. Like this makes
small
no
businesses,
sense.
Right. No, it doesn't. But it is pure rage. There's something I was reading something in about psychology, and there's a term. If you ever like hear an argument between two people, and they start to yell. One of them will go into this voice, and it's like this inhuman. It's like not even. It doesn't sound like them anymore. They've literally like gone like temporarily insane. It's called the it voice. Like it's not. They're no longer them. It's like this monster, and that's what this is. This.
Are you saying that happens in every argument? I think it's only certain people do that.
I'm not like, saying it happens in every argument. Okay. I'm saying. If you ever come, you've seen it. There's an argument, and then it escalates, and one goes off the deep, and it's literally their voice. It's like it's almost speaking in tongues. They're not rational anymore. They're not making any sense in what they're saying, and the voice itself is like this guttural thing from you don't know where, unearthly almost. Psychologists call it the it voice. And that's sort of what we're seeing now in Ferguson is this anarchy and this insanity and chaos. Even though the family have been, very eloquent in saying let's not do this, and it's fallen on deaf ears apparently, which is too bad.
If I was having an argument with someone and the it voice came out, that would scare the crap out of me. I mean,
exactly.
I've been there with one person who was like that, but he was also violent. So, I mean...
but that's usually the next step. It's like losing control. It's almost like something takes over, being possessed in a weird way. It doesn't do anything, as a matter of fact, to those of us who are sort of observing it from the outside, it doesn't help anybody's cause. It doesn't make me want to sympathize with somebody who smashes a car dealership window or torches a squad car on fire.
Yeah.
So it's counterintuitive.
It is. It makes no sense.
But okay, it's irrational and it's emotional.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and finish this discussion. So we'll be back with you in a minute on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were talking about the top story, which is chaos in Ferguson, Missouri, as well as throughout the country, based on the indictment or the lack of indictment of Officer Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown and killed Michael Brown. So Jay is saying that emotions get out of control, and that's why we see this rioting and this looting and this seemingly crazy activity around the country, which I think has no positive effect on the situation whatsoever. This is like completely ineffective protesting, if that's what they're trying to do. But Jay brought up the point, like emotions get out of control. This is true. However, I don't think we should just say, okay, it's emotions, so therefore let's just let it go.
Oh, I don't think anyone's saying that.
All right. So you were mentioning in the break about decisions being made based on emotions as well. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. Well, the problem with that is that emotions change. That's why we got into a discussion about this one time on the show, but legislation is put forth or should be based on a logic, because logic doesn't change.
Yeah. And there's nothing logical about these protests. Nothing whatsoever.
No. But the good news is, I would say that obviously torching a police car, doing damage to someone's property, is illegal. It actually falls under the category of mayhem, which is one of the biggies.
I mean, isn't that vandalism?
No, what has happened there is escalated to mayhem.
Okay. I didn't know there was a legal category. I didn't know there was a criminal category called mayhem.
It's Mayhem is actually, yeah, it's a felony.
Really?
That vandalism is, I spray painted my initials on your wall. Mayhem is, I don't know the exact legal definition of it, but I know it when I see it. How about that? And certainly smashing and that type of this, and it doesn't fall under the category either of redressing grievances with your government either. We've gone beyond that.
Yeah, and you know what? Even just calling it mayhem, that kind of takes the emotional argument off the table, because it implies that there's emotions involved. But hey, guys, emotions are not. It's still a felony.
No, right. But the crime, the motive for the crime isn't necessarily of concern to somebody who's going to indict or arrest or do whatever or adjudicate this entire situation. It is what it is. We'll figure the reasons why later, if we need to, may not need to. You know, they don't, you know, in a murder trial that, you know, person A shoots person B, you know, we don't necessarily, unless it was in self-defense.
Well, no, because whether or not there's a motive says what level of murder it is. Murder one, murder two.
But once they're in court, we're past what they're being charged with. They can't just decide later what they're going to charge them with. You're charged with murder one, you're charged with murder two.
But the charge in those cases does concerns the motive as well. The motive is taken into consideration when the charge is given in murder.
No, actually the circumstances are taken into consideration. Because murder two is heat of the moment and murder one is premeditated.
Yeah, and murder three is?
Pretty much everything else.
Self-defense, everything.
Well, so, yeah, but there are other categories. Then there's involuntary manslaughter.
Manslaughter's an accident. Murder three is you did it, but you didn't intend to before the fact. It just happened based on the circumstances. So therefore, the motive is already established before they get charged when it comes to murder.
Mm.
Maybe not mayhem.
Circumstance, motive would be the reason why. Circumstances is how it all came together. And again, if you know, this is where a lot of times they get into trouble when they overreach and they try someone for murder one, and they should have tried them for murder two, because in their mind they look at again the emotional aspect and they say, well, this guy, he went there looking for trouble, maybe not. But it turns out if they charged the guy with murder two, in many cases, they would have gotten a conviction as opposed to murder one, because the premeditated is actually very difficult to prove. And since we're talking about an individual's freedom, the burden of proof is much larger than it is, obviously, in a civil case.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, Rick, what are your thoughts on all this, and how does it tie into the solution?
To get and prioritize, yes. Well, first of all, I disagree that the emotion is the important thing here. I think what's more important is the underlying feeling of inequality or lack of fairness, et cetera, that drives the emotion. So the facts in this case are so lopsided in favor of the officer that this is a horrible case for people who are concerned with the plight of inner city Black people, etc. Because this example just does not support their case that there's all this, inappropriate violence. So the fact that this is spread in this way is really a symptom of this deeper issue, and that's where we get into cap and prioritize, because there is a lack of social justice as perceived by this entire group of people. And it's not just Blacks, but it's everyone that feels that way, and even rich people could feel like life is unfair, not to them, but to other people. They can be concerned about it. And so this divide we have between the right and left on this issue is real. And it's important, and it's big, it's huge, and it's seemingly impossible to fix because it's so big and so huge and so mystifying. But when it all comes down to it, it's about, look, we have this thing called capitalism, which is really good at helping people who don't need help. You know, I mean, if you've got the right education and the right mindset and the right parents and the right friends and you go to the right school, you're going to do great in capitalism. But what capitalism is not good at is helping the people who are not educated, have the wrong mindset, and the wrong peer group and wrong influences, etc. Okay, now it is true that nothing has done more to help poor people, you know, go into the middle class than capitalism, but then it reaches this kind of its effective point, you know, its maximum there, and it stops helping the furthest down the line. Now that's where we get a lot of people voting for government to help out, and that's going to happen whether you like it or not. If you're on the far right, you're sorry, the government's going to be involved in helping people because people can vote that way. And the only question is, how do we structure it? And that's what we've done wrong. That's what our founding fathers got wrong. They gave politicians a blank check and said, go win elections. And so when that happens, of course, you're going to have a bunch of politicians motivated the wrong way to dramatize these kind of problems and get power because of it. And then you're going to have an opposition party, which we do have, the Republican Party, and we're going to have exactly the fight we're going to have, that we are having. So the solution is to get rid of that blank check. We have to cap government spending, and then to service the need that's there and the desire that's there, the want, we're going to have to take the money that's left and prioritize it so that the people who need help most get priority, and more importantly, I think, the ideas that help them most get priority. I was just reading an article today about how ineffective government programs are across the board, even attempting to help the poorest in the world in Africa. There's so many counterintuitive, unanticipated unintended consequences of all these really well-intentioned actions. And we end up hurting people who are trying to help. So results have to matter. That's the bottom line. Results have to matter. And the only way that's going to happen is if the budget is capped and it's prioritized so that ideas have to compete and the best ideas win. So that's not going to help the Brown family. It's not going to help Ferguson directly anytime soon, because this is like a 20-year battle. But we have to have capitalism do its thing, and then in parallel, have competitive government spending, focusing on people who need help most and the ideas that help them the most, and that's how we eventually get past this. Now, I do just want to say one last thing about the Brown family, because it's not true that they're calling for peace. Okay, what's true is that their attorney is properly guiding them, and so their official message is one of peace. But if you see the video of Michael Brown's stepfather chanting, you know, burn this bitch, okay, I think he's referring to the church that they were near, I'm not sure, repeatedly after the verdict came down, that is not a call for peace. That's not even close, okay? So there's a lot of mixed messages out here, and, we have to filter through it if we're going to be smart, but we shouldn't count on people to be smart.
Yeah, okay. Very good points. Thanks, Rick. All right, so let's take another really quick break here, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. We'll be right back with you on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were talking about the top story still, Ferguson, Missouri, and the riots and demonstrations happening throughout the country. And Rick brought it back home with how cap and prioritizing will solve issues like that in the future. Now we're going to move on to the segment that we call Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick. Now, Jay is considered our government insider, our political insider on the show because of his past involvement working in those capacities. So, Jay, take it away with your inside perspective.
It's all his fault.
It's all his fault. Everything's his fault.
I've never worked for the government. Let me be very clear about that.
Not worked for the government. I said no.
I know. Rick's blaming me.
I was
defending myself here. I was going to talk about something else. I was going to talk about immigration, but I've changed my mind in the last minute, and I want to talk about this a little bit and how it pertains to the overall picture of what we're talking about. And it's when we when we delve into an issue, we muddy the waters so much that we don't that literally there's no clarity. We're in our zeal to paint it as right versus wrong, as opposed to something much more complex than that, and then ultimately coming out with what is actually the correct thing to do. I'll bring it back to Ferguson. There was a confrontation between this officer, I can't remember, Darren Wilson. With Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. One side is saying Michael Brown, I believe at one point they called him the gentle giant. Okay. not so. There's a video of him shoving around a much smaller shop owner, whether it was because their reasons why, whatever. But still, that when you have painted him as the gentle giant, that muddies the waters a little bit. We get further and further from the facts. We get further and further from what actually happened. And then there's distortions on the other side as well with the officer. So, and because we're so scared of any flaw, any slight flaw that you can put onto Michael Brown or Darren Wilson, then they're wrong. This is one of those things that kind of started with, I guess it became more evident. I remember during the presidency of George W. Bush, where everything that he did that was a mistake was followed by, and that's why he should be impeached, and that's why he shouldn't be president. And that's continued on, unfortunately, through the Obama administration. And I think it will continue, unfortunately, until again, we get smarter and more thoughtful about how we talk about these things and say, okay, so he's not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But what really happened here? And that is my, right. That is my piece. And again, cap and prioritize again will force us in a very loving and gentle way to be much more thoughtful and to be smarter and for people to be much more engaged.
Do you think there's some element of political correctness here in using these people as figureheads for a bigger issue? Because if the exact same circumstances, everything exactly the same, except Michael Brown's white and Darren Wilson's black, we wouldn't be hearing anything about this, correct?
To the level we wouldn't be hearing. To the level, yes, we would still hear a police officer shot and killed someone who was unarmed and...
Who was unarmed that he did not know was unarmed at the time that he thought was right. Armed.
Right, right. Yeah.
Which happens all the time, which happens every day in every city. I mean, there's
that's right. There is, but there's, again...
Because police officers have to make a momentary decision based on what they perceive as the facts in that split second. And it's really hard to make a split second decision. I mean, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do that job.
That's right. It's agonizing on both. I'm sure. Well, I'm not sure because I don't know the officer. But my sense is that nobody is happy. No normal person is happy about having to kill another human being.
Exactly.
But when you're in that decision where if he really thought his life was in danger, that is an agonizing decision. I hope I never have to make that decision. I go to bed
and
it's not
just a matter of, okay, you and I on the street, one of us thinks we're in danger. It's not even that. The police officers have a requirement, an obligation to serve and protect the community. So they have to err on the side of thinking he might be armed. Whereas a regular citizen, we might err on the other side and say, oh, okay, well, we might give more benefit of the doubt, but we're not required to protect other people. It's a different circumstance that he's in.
No, and the rules of engagement have changed drastically over the past 30, 40 years. I remember growing up in Montgomery County, Maryland, and there was a picture on the wall in the police station because I was a Cub Scout. We went on tour there, and there was one officer who had been killed in the line of duty since 1950, and this was in the 70s.
Right.
Now that number has exponentially grown. The the rules of engagement have changed because they've had to, because police officers are much more at risk. I'm not condoning what Officer Wilson did or didn't do, but the rules of engagement have drastically changed because the threat has drastically changed.
Right, and again, we don't know what actually happened. We don't know
what the dynamics were.
Yeah, so we can't really say. However, I can say that police officers are under a lot of stress and they have to make split-second decisions, and they have to make those decisions in line with what they've vowed to do, which is to serve and protect the community. So if he had decided, okay, I'm not going to shoot because I'm not sure, and then it turned out that Michael Brown was armed and the officer ended up dead, then other people could have ended up dead, and the officer has failed his position of what he's supposed to do. So
that's right. Yeah. It's just, these are agonizing decisions. Any policeman I know that is a good policeman, they do not want to be in that situation. To them, a good day is when the phone doesn't ring. That is a good day. And unfortunately good days very rarely happen. I started, what I said was that there are no winners, only losers in this situation, sadly.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Okay. Rick, thoughts? In between your coughing fits there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, I think there is a winner here. Everyone says there's no winners. Everyone says it's nothing good can come from the protest. And, you know, I'm going to take the counterintuitive position on it, and I'm going to say that this is part of history. This is part of the fire. You know, the Billy Joel song, "We Didn't Fight the Fire," right? This is part of the fire that that propels us to make changes. And it's not always clear what the end will be. It's not clear that it's certainly not an easy step forward or a clear step forward. But these are the kind of things that force us to pay attention to things like social justice. And so it crystallizes it in our head. And so people complain about the polarization of the country. They complain about how this other group isn't thinking, you know, they're only acting based on emotion or whatever. And all these things have a degree of truth and a limit to how truthful they are, too. But you add it all up together, and somehow humanity ends up making progress. And it's because of things like this. And so, obviously it's a tragedy for the family. It's a tragedy for the community. It's a sad, state for the nation. But, we had to fight a civil war to end slavery. I mean, and you wouldn't say that didn't serve a purpose. It did.
And in fact, every tragedy and everything that we label negative does have a positive side, such as this. But I do agree with Jay that as far as the two people in this go, there are no winners. but there's always a bigger picture, and this is definitely, I mean, it's caught people's awareness. It's fostered discussions around the country, not just crazy protests, but actual logical, intelligent discussions as well. So that's a good thing.
Well, it also makes it very clear that the election of Barack Obama to president did not mean that we are now a post-racial country. However, so far, if you look at the big incidents that have happened in the last 8 years, most of the claims of racism have been proven false. After they've been looked at. And so really we're in kind of this political correct era of racism where smaller and smaller things are labeled racism because they have political value. But that's actually a sign of progress. When it gets to be so silly that that the people, the accusers just get laughed at, that's when racism will finally end.
Yeah, good point. Exactly. All right. So any final thoughts on the inside perspective before we take a break and come back with outside perspective? Jay?
No, I think we've settled it.
Wrapped it up. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So in a few minutes, we'll be back with the outside perspective, affectionately known as Rick's Rant. We'll be back with you in a few minutes on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Emmernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were talking about the inside perspective with Jay Emmernick, which continued our theme today so far, which has been talking about the events in Ferguson, Missouri, and the resulting, or according to Rick, not resulting, just coincidental riots around the country.
No.
Well, you said it would have. It wasn't a result of those instances, that it would have happened anyway. That's what you said.
Well, I will admit that that is the trigger. Okay,
yeah.
It triggered the protest, but it's not the cause of the protest, is my argument. It's
okay. Okay, fine line, but yeah. Okay, I get it. All right, so
it's a fine line. Very important line. Very important line.
Yeah, okay. But, it sounds like you're saying that we're in such unrest and such anger that we're just waiting for, like, when I say we, obviously, not us individually sitting here on this radio show, but us as a community, as a whole, as a society, is just waiting for a chance to rant and destroy things.
Apparently the Ferguson community was, absolutely. Because something bad happened, and they instantly took it as the worst possible way it could be perceived, and stuck with it, and rioted, and so on. And now
but that spread
later,
like wildfire. It spread like a virus around the country. So
yeah.
So it would be that people around the country were waiting for that.
We in the upper middle class white community may not feel that same kind of angst. But in that community, it was clearly there. It was waiting for the next moment.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's have
an interesting question.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry. We got a little delay here. I have a question for the group.
Okay.
How much worse would the riots have been if it really was an inappropriate shooting?
Would hope that they would probably be worse, wouldn't they?
Well, in the mind of the people who were protesting, in the mind of the people who were rioting, and looting and everything like that, it was an inappropriate shooting.
But wouldn't there be more people, if it really was inappropriate, wouldn't there be more people on board with that thought process and thinking that it is, and therefore more people would have got involved in the protests?
I guess there's really two scenarios here. One scenario is where it actually wasn't appropriate, and the grand jury finds the police officer innocent anyway, in spite of what is perceived as a case that should go to court at least. And then there's the case where the grand jury finds that this police officer may have acted inappropriately. We can't decide, so court has to. And I think in either of those scenarios, I guess it would be worse. But then the question becomes, would a grand jury, find the officer innocent if it wasn't very, very clear that he or she was? And I find it very hard to believe that, given how easy it is for a grand jury to indict people, that the grand jury would make that error. So really we're looking at the scenario we have now versus, if it had gone to court. And if it had gone to court, I don't know. It's just interesting that, because the case was so clear. The evidence here was so clearly in favor of the officer that all the protests are just clearly, therefore, unjustified. And they're just nuts. And that speaks to the mob mentality and the inability to make a good decision as a group here. So I don't know. It's just interesting to me.
It is interesting. Yeah, definitely.
The Bar Association actually came out with a statement saying that they were actually surprised that they decided not to indict, and actually concerned with how it was, how the evidence was handled. I believe that was the gist of their statement. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not a, you know, the judicial branch is sort of the one I have the least familiarity with. So I don't know how these things really work. But I don't know that the evidence is so clear one way or the other. And if there is, there's also a sense, again, of disenfranchisement on the part of the citizens of Ferguson, that they feel like, well, you know, it's rigged. This is, you know, this is tainted evidence, or it's BS. I don't know.
Yeah. Not sure.
Exactly.
All right, so let's have the outside perspective, a.k.a. Rick's rant. Go ahead, Rick. Go ahead and rant for us.
Okay, the rant today is against people who think we can keep doing what we've done before to fix the problem. So now this is on both the left and the right. Okay, the left thinks they can keep on protesting, they can keep on demanding more spending or higher taxes on the rich, et cetera. And somehow they'll solve their problems that they haven't been able to solve, even though we're spending $2.3 trillion a year in wealth transfer. The left still isn't happy with the results because, you know, we don't have the good results that they want. And on the political right, people who think that we can just keep on arguing for limited government and how good capitalism is, how good, how prosperous we'll be if capitalism is set free from the burden of government. You know, these arguments are arguments that appeal to the political right base, but they don't do a bit of good helping the left move over to the right. And vice versa, the left arguments don't do a bit of good reaching out to the right to help the right want to help people through government action. The solution is cap and prioritize. We have to do something new here. And this new thing is that, to those of you on the political right, you have to just take a step back and say, you know what? We want the right to vote because we don't want a dictator. But if we're going to have the right to vote, people are going to vote to be helped. And they're going to vote to help people they care about. And so we're going to be in the helping people business in government, whether we like it or not. The only question is, what are the limits and how is it prioritized? And if you're on the left and you want to help people better through government, you got to take a step back and say, wow, you know what? We can't help people more by spending more. Not anymore. Yeah, maybe when we were spending zero. In 1794, maybe then we could spend more to help people. But at this point, we cannot spend more and expect to help people. And so we have to spend better. And spending better is all about prioritizing. So whether you're on the left or the right, it all comes down to, you know, what can we afford, you know, and then how are we going to prioritize? That's the question. Cap and prioritize.
Okay. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's exactly, and it's what we've talked about so often on the show. But it's literally in the political lexicon, in the legislative lexicon, the word that is least used, least applied, is efficacy, is effectiveness. It is all sort of fluff, unfortunately. We talk about Senator A puts forth the "I love puppies" bill. Senator B votes against it because, in fact, it doesn't help puppies at all. It doesn't do anything of the sort. And he says, no, this is a piece of junk legislation. I'm not going to vote for it. He votes against it. And what happens? Senator A comes out and he goes, oh, my opponent has voted and hates puppies because he voted against the I Love Puppy Bill, right? And I use that as a very simple and colorful thing, but and then it's all over Facebook, and there's a meme of this senator strangling a puppy or something like that. But it's pure nonsense. And until we actually look at what the bill does, or proposed bill does, we're never going to get past this. And this is, again, why cap and prioritize is so important, because it forces us, in a very gentle and loving way, to look at these things and say, okay, what really works?
Aw, gentle and loving.
Well, because I hate to say. Well, good, because government force is a very scary concept. So it is. So it is. It's lowercase forces us to just by the nature of the concept and the construct of it, we will have to look at the efficacy of a particular piece of legislation. Does it do what it says it's going to do? Instead of just saying, here's the problem, let's throw more money at it, which also comes from sort of a very human emotion of avarice, you know, and to say, look, I'm not whole because somebody else has made all the money, which is, you know, nonsense. So we've got to take the money away from them and throw it into education or whatever like that, but we keep spending more money on it and it's not improving anything. It's not moving the needle. So clearly we need to look at how it's being applied.
Yeah. Rick, what do you think?
Now, there's I just want to take the last few minutes here and jump to another topic because we there's two things that happened this week that we're going to miss if we don't cover them this week. And the first is immigration with Obama's declaration that he's going to create kind of a safe haven for about 5 million illegal immigrants. My take on that is, if you don't like it, elect someone different next time. Because we've known since before our government was formed that there's a chance for people to abuse power. And we have systems in place for that, and it's called elections and checks and balances. In this case, he's on the edge of the check and balance ability to kind of rein him in. But there's still the next election. So if you don't like it, vote.
You said don't vote because your vote doesn't matter.
Yeah, your vote doesn't matter.
His position is involved.
The whole left side. Okay. We have to cap and prioritize ultimately. But on that one particular issue, if you don't like a person in that one position of power, that's when the vote really matters. I'm talking about voting. Voting left is not going to get rid of the right leaning party. Voting right isn't going to get rid of the left leaning party. So the party as a system exists, but if you don't like one particular person and their abuse of power, then the vote does matter. I go for that. The other issue is okay. Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby increasingly looks like the most successful serial rapist ever. It's sad across the board, but it just goes to show how you just can't trust the media appearance. This speaks back to Ferguson, actually, where, you know, all of these people who are protesting and rioting and so on, you know, they have an impression of what happened. And, we all, on all sides, we all have to take a second and third look to really understand what's really going on in all of these different issues.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that all three of those things that we brought up have race components as well, and people making decisions and making judgments based on race or not race, or what's politically correct or not politically correct. But I guess that's, you know, it keeps coming up as a topic on this show as well. And according to Rick, we are evolving out of the age of racism. So maybe this is part of it.
Yep. It's just next step.
All right. So we haven't had anything. Are we almost done? Technically, but Doug hasn't given us the 2-minute warning or anything.
The high sign,
yeah. Yeah. So, okay, Jay, what are your thoughts on the couple of stories that... All right, 2 minutes.
So very quickly, Bill Cosby is a... to me, that's incredibly heartbreaking on a couple levels, and I'll start with the sort of first most important one, is that he has caused... If these allegations are true, has caused irreparable damage to many, many... lives, and the second is that growing up he was he was a big influence on me. I grew up listening to his comedy records, to watching Fat Albert, to watching his to watching I Spy, where he was actually a very positive black role model. It was him and Bob Culp and Bill Cosby, his character Alexander Scott, was like the intellectual, the smart one, the cosmopolitan who spoke like 9 different languages, and Bob Culp was sort of the dumb jock. And it was a great, it was a terrific show. And then his show, he had a couple show called the Bill Cosby Show, and then a couple others in there, where he was, a very positive influence, a positive role model. And it's just a terrible thing. And it's sort of our heroes are not what they seem to be. And yes, someone who worked in Hollywood, I can tell you that the perception, what you see on the screen, is not what goes on behind the grease paint and so forth and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, we're out of time for today. It's been a very interesting show. A lot of good discussions going on. Join us back next week right here on the station or at politicalfixradio.com. I'm Heather Vale, and on behalf of my co-hosts, Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz, have a fantastic week. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll catch you back here next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vale Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.